The title of this presentation is Global Governance in the 21st Century, the Future at Risk. I will divide my remarks in four parts. I will first speak and provide a brief history of world order ideas. I will then talk about the League of Nations. From then on, I will discuss the United Nations and the UN Charter. And I will conclude by sharing some thoughts on the future of global governance. The UN Charter, endorsed in 1945 by 51 nations, sought to lay a groundwork for a new world order. Let me quote a couple of passages from the UN Charter. It says, "To save succeeding generations from the scourge of war and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights and the equal rights of men and women, to establish conditions under which justice and respect for international law can be maintained, and to promote social progress and better standards of life, and to employ international machinery for the promotion of the economic and social advancement of all peoples." And then it goes on to say, "We the peoples have resolved to establish an international organization to be known as the United Nations." Now, calls for a new world order or for a rearrangement of our systems of governance go back, in fact, a long time. Believe it or not, in the year 1311, Dante Alighieri wrote a political tract under the title of De Monarchia, which was translated into English in the United States and published in 1945 with a very provocative title, On World Government. And in that, Dante wrote, and I quote, "It is evident that mankind, too, is most free and easy to carry on its work when it enjoys the quiet and tranquility of peace. To achieve this state of universal well-being, a single world government is necessary." In an essay titled Towards the Present and Future Peace of Europe, written in 1693, William Penn made the case for a federal European state to keep the peace. This state would govern relations between the members within a common legal framework, including a supranational parliament. Penn's essay is an excellent example of the extent to which poverty and the prevalence of violence and war among states prompted leading thinkers at the time to make proposals aimed at securing a more solid foundation for peace and prosperity. 20 years later, the French cleric Charles Castel de Saint-Pierre, in his plan for the perpetual peace in Europe, called for the creation of an European confederation. Saint-Pierre was a very interesting character. He was a cleric, but he was very much in demand in the French salons of the day because of his scholarship and his charisma. He passed away in 1743, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau inherited his papers, came into contact with Saint-Pierre's thinking and adopted many of his views. Later on, imbued with Saint-Pierre's idealism and very interesting insights, Rousseau lamented Europe's, quote, "perpetual dissensions, brigandage, usurpations, rebellions, wars, and murders," and called for the creation of a government confederation where, I quote, "all its members must be placed in such a mutual state of dependence that not one of them alone may be in a position to resist all of the others." This was, in fact, one of the earliest calls for the establishment of a system of collective security. One of the most important experiments in international cooperation, of course, came in the late 18th century in America. Alexander Hamilton had said that, and I quote, "if men were angels, no government would be necessary." that people must be brought under the mild and salutary coercion of the law if they are to avoid the destructive coercion of the sword. What emerged was a system that sought to balance the interests of states with the need to have a strong central government that would operate under the rule of law and with clearly identified limitations on its powers. Benjamin Franklin, America's first ambassador to the French court, wrote in 1787 the following to a friend back in France: "If the Constitution succeeds, I do not see why you might not form a federal union of one grand republic of all its different states and kingdoms by means of a like convention." The American experience points to the benefits of federalism under the rule of law. There were vast advantages for the U.S. as a result of the creation of an integrated single economic space. By the early part of the 20th century, the United States was already emerging as the world's largest and most dynamic economy, something that in turn was reflected, of course, in growing political power. Immanuel Kant, who was born in 1724 and lived during much of the 18th century, said that the problem of international order was, and I quote, "the most difficult and the last to be solved by the human race. Men form states to constrain their passions," he said, "but each state sought to preserve its absolute freedom, even at the cost of a lawless state of savagery. But the devastations, upheaval, and even complete inner exhaustion of their powers arising from interstate clashes would in time oblige men to contemplate an alternative. Humanity," he said, "faced either the peace of the vast graveyard of the human race or peace by reason design." Kant's proposal for this peace by reason design was a voluntary federation of nations within a framework of respect for agreed rules of conduct, and where citizens would no longer wish to face the rigors and consequences of armed conflict. Kant's League of Nations, or League of Peace, would evolve into a peaceful world order and, to use his phrase, a perfect civil union of mankind.